Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
So, Kate Tamarello, welcome to RTP.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so we are in the middle of a deep dive into the little tech agenda. And I am so glad we have you here because there's a temptation to think that good policy ideas come from the ivory tower, where I usually reside, or from the hill, which is just in our backyard. And yet, I think you are very well situated to tell us that good policy is probably going to come from a different source. And your role at Engine provides you with a unique insight into that. So can you tell us briefly what the heck is Engine and what's your role there?
Yeah, absolutely. So Engine is a nonprofit based in DC that works with a network of several thousand startups across the country to advocate for pro-innovation, pro-entrepreneurship, pro-startup policy. We were founded in late 2011 in the midst and then wake of SOPA PIPA, which could be and has been its own podcast. And really the goal was just to create a seat at the table for startups. I think it was clear in the early 2010s that tech policy and internet policy was a thing that was going to kind of continue to be a conversation. And while a lot of the large tech companies have lobbyists, have offices in DC, have whole policy teams, most startups, you know, aren't thinking about policy. And they should be, because policy will impact them. And so over the last now 13 and a half years, we've been working to make sure that their voices are heard and that they are keyed into important debates, but also have a platform for expressing, you know, not just their experience, but how policy impacts their experience. And I am Engine's executive director. I handle a bunch of issues, most notably and most recently, all of our content moderation, intermediary liability work. But I've worked on privacy and AI and talent and telecom and a whole bunch of other stuff in my career at Engine. So yeah, we're excited to talk about little tech agenda.
Yeah, so just the easy issues for the executive director then. That's good to hear.
Yes.
So when it comes to actually reaching out to startups, you could imagine a superficial way of doing that, of just saying, hey, we'll send around an annual survey and check a couple boxes. I want to know more about your actual engagement with founders themselves and how you are actively learning about the sorts of regulatory barriers that we want something like the little tech agenda or any pro-innovation agenda to address.
Yeah, so Engine is a 7-person team, I should start it by saying, and two of us, we have a 2-person grassroots team. All they do is talk to startup founders all day. And that's a lot of kind of cold outreach. We heard about your company, we think it's cool, but it's also being connected through ecosystem support orgs, incubators, accelerators, investors, other founders we know. And then we just talk to them, which is a crazy idea. We just listen to them.
It's wild. Yeah.
We need more of that, I think. And we tend to start every relationship with a founder with like a 30 to 45 minute phone call. And we ask, and it's usually grassroots team and then some policy team members. I sit on them pretty frequently. And we just ask kind of, what's your experience been? What are the hurdles you've encountered? How could policy make your life easier? How is policy making your life harder? And I think every founder has their own story. Every company has its own kind of approach. And we hear a really wide range of issues. Sometimes in DC, it can feel like tech policy or startup policy is all, you know, whatever Google cares about, whatever Meta cares about. And there's some of that in there. Certainly, we work on that stuff too. But a lot of it's stuff that only startups care about. We constantly are thinking about ways to make it easier to raise angel money. That's not something that Google cares about. Why would they? Or if they care about it, it's out of a, you know, virtuous to help the ecosystem, not for their own bottom line. But for startups, that's like the number one problem they encounter, or the first problem they encounter, is that early, early money. So I think we get a really interesting perspective into the entire ecosystem. And, you know, we have companies in our network that are like one person at a desk in a co-working space. And we have companies that we've worked with for the last 10 years that have grown into, at, you know, mid-tech and maybe even larger companies. So we get to see kind of the whole lifespan, the whole spectrum of issues. And it's really those like one-on-one or one-on-three or four on the Engine side conversations that help inform our policy advocacy.
And something that Colin pointed out for the podcast is that when you look at the just sheer personnel of big tech, for example, they have hundreds, if not thousands, of public policy folks, of lawyers, and that's just internally. Then, of course, they have the resources to be able to hire outside counsel, to go get other consultants to inform policy initiatives. And I also think that there's a sort of popular narrative now that's building that, you know, folks aren't in garages anymore. We don't see startups forming of just Joe and Jane getting together and starting something. No, everything's some San Francisco-based company, or they started in a New York incubator, and that's what little tech means now. Can you give us a broader analysis of what does the little tech landscape look like for you? What does it mean to be a little tech company?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's probably a joke in there that if they've moved away from garages, it's only because they're not in Silicon Valley, where you can be in an uninsulated garage all year round. And in Omaha, you need to be in an actual building.
There you go.
So if they're leaving garages, it's just because of they're more geographically diverse, and I think that perception lends itself. The idea that this is only happening on the coast is totally wrong. We have startups in every state. We have startups in our network in every congressional district. This is everywhere. I think that's the beauty of the internet. We always say with a good idea and a strong internet connection, you can launch a global business these days. That wasn't true always. And that's, I think, worth celebrating and worth policy protecting. I think this idea that there are no startups, there are no little tech companies anymore is really strange. And then who am I talking to all day?
Right.
We talked to those founders.
Just really good AI.
Yeah, right. Wow, that would be impressive. And right, this is the idea that like the tech market or industry has matured to the point where there's no more competition or there's no room for entry is completely wrong. I think we see products that 5 years ago I couldn't have imagined that are on the market now because of startups. And so this landscape is changing, certainly, but I don't think that means it's shrinking. It's growing and it's getting easier and easier, right? With AI and with all of like the software tools that are out there, it's easier to launch a tech company now. And you have people who maybe don't have technical backgrounds but have great ideas being able to partner pretty easily with either the tools or the people with the technical backgrounds to launch tech startups. And I think that's awesome. And it's everywhere. It's across all sectors of the economy. And it's, yeah, like I said, people with one person with a good idea to, you know, able to grow into companies with hundreds of team members.
And when you think about these little tech with little guys or few gals, how that carries over into a regulatory conversation of what does it mean for such a small team of 1 to 4 folks to have to deal with different regulatory hurdles? I think that you at Engine did an excellent report on the privacy patchwork.
Mm-hmm.
And you all penciled it out, collaborating with Michigan's Public Policy School, that for each additional new state comprehensive privacy bill, it would cost somewhere between $15,000 and $60,000 in compliance costs. And listeners may think, oh, well, you know, for Meta, that's what they probably spend on their next big bash to listen to Jay-Z or something like that. What does that mean for a startup? And what does that in particular mean for who they have to go and hire, who they have to go and find? Because if it's just you and your homies from high school starting in a garage or the Omaha equivalent of a garage, you may not have that super public policy savvy person or that administrative law lawyer. So what's that look like for these teams to actually just attempt to comply with various regulations?
Yeah, I should say that report was put out when there were 5 state privacy laws. There are many, many more now. And I think the interesting thing about that 15 to 60K figure is that almost all just like compliance costs, updating vendor contracts, updating privacy policy. That's not actually changing any practices, right? So that money almost entirely is without any benefit to the user. It's not like suddenly privacy is increasing because companies are spending that money. It's just going to compliance efforts on the legal side. And so when you compare that cost to a number we have in our research, that the average seed stage startup, so that's already a startup that's bringing in outside money, has a product, is pretty successful. The average seed stage startup has about $55,000 a month to spend on everything, right? Equipment, personnel, research, customer acquisition, you name it.
Partners.
Yeah, that too, if they have any. So those, right, like suddenly a new state privacy law coming online means a month less runway. And that's, I think, really dangerous when you think about wanting to create an ecosystem where startups can thrive. One of the things that always stands out to me is several years ago during a fly-in, we had a Hill meeting with, I don't know, probably like 10 founders in the room and some Hill staff. And one of the staffers asked, like, oh, how many of you have a lawyer on staff? And everybody laughed. It's Like, no, we don't. We're like five people. We don't have a lawyer on staff. If you need us to do something with a lawyer, we have to pay thousands and thousands of dollars with our outside counsel, right? We have a lawyer that we can go to, but it's not cheap and it's not included in their salary. And even Engine, you know, we're a small team. When we have to rewrite our privacy policy, it's very expensive. I have to work with our outside counsel. So we get it firsthand. And I think this misconception that, like, oh, that's the cost of doing business. And it's like, of course, privacy is the a privacy compliance regime in your company is the cost of doing business. I don't think any startup thinks, we don't care about this. We don't care if our users feel like they're protected. We're willing to do whatever we want at zero cost, right? They build that in when they're building their product. But for the landscape to keep changing every 3 months at this point, costs a lot of time and money. And that's time and money that's not spent building the product they set out to build. And I'm sure other folks in the investor space can speak better to this, but we've heard from investors, it's like, well, we don't want to write you a check that goes right to your lawyers.
Right.
We want to write you a
check
that goes
to building.
Who wants
to pay lawyers? I get it.
Yeah. So I think it's those numbers hopefully help illustrate the imbalance here between, like, what are we actually getting for this money and what are we sacrificing? And for startups, it's like the ability to hire an engineer to build the thing, which is not small potatoes.
Mm-hmm. Big potatoes, indeed. maybe crispy, too. But thinking too of the opportunity cost, I think that's something that you all excellently flag of saying, okay, Kate's time working with that pesky lawyer, thinking about that privacy policy, you could have been talking with founders, identifying new insights, helping them connect with lawmakers, all of these other things. And what I think is also a distinguishing factor, and I'd love to hear your perspective on this, is when the startups are trying to comply with regulations, it's almost always reactive. There's not a lot of time they can spend in state capitals or in DC shaping legislation to comport with their needs. On the flip side, it's hard pressed. I can tell you, even in Salem, Oregon, where I was briefly a little aspiring lobbyist, you will find big tech lobbyists filling those halls, shaping legislation. Do we see any of that sort of effort from little tech, or how is that sort of proactive posture working in practice?
Yeah, I think it's groups like Engine, right? And there are plenty of others, and not just mean us. And you know, we're not we don't have a ton of resources to deploy lobbyists in every state capital. But I think their right startup stories, the startup perspective, really does help shape policy, especially at the state level, where like you have lawmakers who don't necessarily have giant teams of technical experts. So I think that's so valuable, but it's very, very hard to do. Grateful for the groups that we work with that do it, and certainly Engine tries to do it at the federal level and sometimes at the state level. But yeah, it's really hard to fold in that perspective, especially given kind of like the wide portfolios that legislatures are working on, and the fact that some of this stuff is just complicated. It's some of it's like technologically difficult to get right. And while we would hope that would mean that lawmakers would be cautious and seek out perspectives, that's not always what happens. There's not always time and resources to do that. And so I think I believe obviously startups should be involved, and many of them want to be involved. And I think it's up to groups like Engine to make that path to involvement as easy as possible.
And when we're thinking about how the sort of new wave of technology is being introduced and we have the potential of a new patchwork forming, we'll hear from a lot of folks, and we've heard it in this podcast series, that, oh, it's not that big of a concern because acts like the RAISE Act in New York, which is the Responsible AI Safety and Education Act, or the Colorado AI Act, which at the time of this recording is potentially going to be watered down by Governor Polis, but that's another pod. We'll hear from the advocates of those pieces of legislation, oh, startups have nothing to worry about because we have an explicit compute threshold, for example, in the AI context that says if you're not releasing a frontier model, this doesn't apply to you, or perhaps we'll say you have to have a certain budgetary threshold. So don't worry, little tech, we've got you. What's your counter? Is it really, can startups just say, oh, I trust the legislator, I'm just going to ignore this law and everything's going to be fine, Jesus take the wheel?
No, they don't. The responsible ones, which is most of them, don't say that, thankfully. I think there's like several things to think about when thinking about legislation that has a small business or startup carve out. One is that no startup wants to stay small, or at least none of the startups we've talked to. They want to grow, or they want to become part of a large company ultimately, and right, like that's how they attract investment. That's is the idea that they will get bigger and become successful and make a ton of money. And so I think any, just generally when Engine thinks about small business carve outs, not in the AI context, but generally, if at some arbitrary threshold, because they're all ultimately arbitrary, you have to entirely rework your business model, you're going to do that from day one, because you can't grow to be 10 million users, let's say, and then when you hit that 10 millionth in one, suddenly you need to reshape your entire business. You're not going to be able to do that. You just have to build the business you ultimately end up at from day one. So I think those thresholds don't make a ton of sense, especially when they're user-based, because those numbers are not really a great metric.
Well, and just to pause there for a second, it's wonky from a incentive standpoint too.
Yes.
Just going to like public policy 101,
yes.
If we have a bunch of startups who presumably we all want startups to do well, but you say, hey, the second you cross that threshold and your 500th user or your 500,000th mm-hmm. user, which is not a fun thing to say, but if you hit that threshold, all of a sudden you're gonna get slapped with a ton of new regulatory mechanisms.
Yeah. You avoid the threshold.
You avoid the threshold, and that's not good for the market. That's not good for competition. That's not good for what everyone claims they are purportedly in support of. So, yeah, this is just a bad policy driver, too.
Yeah, I mean, we've come down on the side of there are some instances where if it's like, I always think of it as administrative work, okay. If we're like giving startups a runway to, in the privacy context, for instance, ramp up to dealing with user access correction deletion requests, fine. Maybe it makes sense. Day one, you don't need to do that, but by year three, you do. But that's not like, again, reworking your entire business model. I think that's, if that's the cost of complying, then like, why would you ever grow? Why would you ever want to do that? So that's kind of when I think about carve outs generally. In the AI context, it's really interesting because it seems like a lot of these proposals misunderstand that the vast majority of startup innovation in AI is happening at the application layer. It is very expensive and very time consuming to build a foundation model. People do, or like startups do it, companies that start up grow to be able to do it. But the vast majority of true startups building with AI are building off of existing foundation models. And so if it becomes either outright prohibited or incredibly expensive and complicated to offer those foundation models to developers, the companies offering them, which are large companies for the most part, won't have the incentive to offer them anymore. It would, I mean, if you look at like an open source foundation model, they're not even like making huge amounts of money off of that. If it becomes like this huge legal bill and this big compliance headache, why would they keep offering that to developers? So startups won't have access to this foundational building block of foundation models if regulation makes it too complicated to offer those foundation models. And so while, yes, they're not like directly implicated or, you know, they're scoped out of things like the RAISE Act, I think that maybe misunderstands how the ecosystem works and the fact that this tool of a foundation model is so critical to building the product that without it, the product doesn't exist.
And this gets your point of, for so many policymakers, they'll say, oh, well, I went and talked to the labs. And they're referring to, you know, Meta, they're referring to OpenAI, they're referring to DeepMind. I talked to the labs, I held a public comment period or whatever. But none of that's getting to those second order effects. And I'm not going to accurately attribute this, so listeners, please do it on my behalf. But there's a great economist line that says, you know, a fine economist thinks about first order ramifications. A great economist is thinking about those second order conditions. And in the context of AI, blockchain, biotech, these are all really complex industries. And so for you to think that just going through the first order ramifications is sufficient to say, ah, job done, policy looks good, it's just kind of lazy policymaking, in my opinion. But without going too much deeper into that, to go and look specifically at the Little Tech Agenda. So we've have the Little Tech Agenda as espoused by Mark Andreessen and Ben Horowitz in their essay from 2024. We have the American Innovators Network and their explicit agenda, kind of really prioritizing workforce training, reskilling, upskilling, lowering barriers to entry, making some of the core infrastructure components of tech development more broadly available. From your seat at Engine, in the driver's seat, sorry for the car metaphor, I can't help myself, what is that agenda missing, or what would you like to see prioritized and kind of brought to the fore?
Yeah. So I think, you know, like I said, Engine's been around since late 2011. I'm always down for a rebrand. So welcome the conversation about Little Tech. I think we've been talking about startups for 13 years. And the number one thing we hear, like I said, is about access to capital. That's the first problem most founders encounter, especially founders outside of Silicon Valley and New York. And frankly, especially founders who aren't like Stanford grads, right? Which like, that's great too. But we want to, I think the ecosystem thrives when everyone can access it. And that means making sure we're not just talking about Stanford grads in Palo Alto building startups.
I agree. But as a Berkeley Bear, Stanford doesn't need any more money. Sorry, Cardinal.
So we're really interested in making sure the Omaha startups succeed, making sure the Memphis startups succeed, and many, many more. And the number one problem, or the first problem they encounter, is raising enough money to build the product. And there's so many, right? That's a very hard problem to solve across the board. I'm not suggesting that we create a federal program that just writes checks to everybody with an idea. But there are policy levers that we can pull, and I would argue we should pull, to make it easier for private investment. Things like expanding the definition of accredited investor at the SEC, and which is like pretty bipartisan. The House has passed legislation. We've been talking about this for years and years. But it never quite makes it across the finish line. And so I think things like that, making crowdfunding easier, there's a bunch of kind of weird restrictions around crowdfunding that make it tough. Things like that, that would just help founders get the money to build the thing. And I think, and this is totally fair, we all occupy different spaces in the ecosystem, but if you're a VC firm coming at this debate, or if you're even like an incubator accelerator coming at this debate, you don't see that problem. Mm-hmm. You're dealing with companies that by definition have your money. And so they're not worried maybe about the accredited investor definition. We deal with the companies before they reach that point, and often right through that point. We have plenty of companies that have been through incubators and accelerators in our network, but we're not looking for that specifically. And so I think we have that unique vantage point of seeing companies before they get that first check. And that's the barrier they're encountering. But then there's also things like access to talent. I think there's a lot of kind of immigration things that could be done to make it easier to have high-skilled talent, especially high-skilled founders who want to come build companies in the U.S. That would be a huge win. And then we're also looking at the things where we have to play defense. I think there's a lot of issues and a lot of policy frameworks that work pretty well. And because they work well, it's hard to appreciate them. It's very easy to take them for granted. And so I'm thinking of, because I work on this, the intermediary liability frameworks that mean you can't get sued every time your user, a user on your platform posts something that infringes someone's copyright, for instance, or other things. I think there's just a lot of frameworks that work relatively well, and we see the need to defend them, but maybe folks not in DC don't see those debates as clearly. And so those are the things that, like, when I think of the startup agenda, that's what I'm thinking of.
And there's an argument to be made, and thankfully we have Dave on the podcast to air this argument more fully, but I'm curious to hear your take that, you know, all this focus on little tech, maybe there's too much, right? A company is a company and the market's going to figure itself out, or these are just businesses that we want to encourage. We certainly don't want to inhibit good folks from doing good things. But this emphasis on little tech building the future and saving America and bringing forward a better tomorrow, it's just, it's a myth, and we're leaning into it too heavily. What's your take?
I disagree.
Oh, shocker.
I think, you know, right, new businesses are the majority creator of new jobs. And especially, like, I'm talking about it in Omaha, for instance. We have a great founder in Omaha, so he's top of mind right now.
I was going to say, did he cut you a deal on steaks or something?
Yeah,
or,
no. Yeah. I know. I should get into that somehow. I love Omaha, though. It's lovely. And, right, that's an ecosystem that, like, doesn't have a ton of outside funding. The founders there need to be able to use their money to build the product, not to spend on lawyers and regulatory compliance. And so when we're talking about policy frameworks that work for little tech, in my mind, it's, again, it's not just to support Silicon Valley Stanford grads, although they're in here too, but it's to create innovation ecosystems across the country. And that's I think, pretty bipartisan. I hope everyone understands the value in that, but I absolutely think there are founders creating companies, launching companies, building products today that will make life better in the future, and we should find a way for policy to support them.
And kind of going a little deeper even into that narrative, I'm curious if you feel that the Hulu special on Theranos, followed by the Netflix special on WeWork, followed by so on and so forth, just all this attention to the worst of little tech or even mid tech or whatever we want to call it. Is that making your conversations with policymakers harder? Do you find that there's this pervasive sense that moving fast and break things applies even to the Omaha founder or even to the Memphis founder, even though, for lack of a better phrase, they're building a boring blockchain product mm-hmm. or the most run-of-the-mill AI thing, or their biotech is like a better Band-Aid? What can you add some color to? Maybe not all little tech is trying to scam you out of money.
Yeah, I guarantee you, the vast majority of little tech is not trying to scam you out of money. I think it's interesting to think about that question in the AI context. I think it's so easy for these like narratives to kind of stick in the public perception, and generative AI is the best example of this. We work with so many generative AI startups. Again, they're using foundation models and they're building very, very niche products. And most of them are quite boring if you are not a user. And I always describe them as like innocuous and benign. Like they are running in the background of software you already use. And I think like when you think about like autofill in text, right? That's generative AI. That is AI that is generating characters based on what it thinks you, what you want to or going to say. But when we talk about generative AI publicly, it's like, oh, will this foundation model interface replicate a Marvel movie? And like, what questions do that raise? And it's like, that's interesting. We should have that conversation, but that's not actually generative AI. That is one specific use. And so, yes, I think especially in that context, the conversation around, isn't this terrible? Isn't this horrible? Isn't this robbing creatives? Isn't this taking up all the energy, right? It sucks the oxygen out of the room. It makes it really, really hard to have a conversation about the SaaS AI company that's helping HR professionals automate payroll or whatever, right. Which is like a lot of yes. startups doing those things. And it's because they come from an HR background and they see these problems and they see how automation can solve them. And they are making life easier for other HR professionals in this example. And that product like should exist and the people who use it love it, but it's maybe has a generative AI component. And I think that's where Engine tries to step in and tell that story, because that's that like very tangible example of, oh, here's a way technology is being used to make life easier for people that has nothing to do with recreating Marvel movies, but it's the same underlying technology. I think that's, in our mind, how we move towards a more productive debate.
Yeah, and you and I will have to talk about the AI benefits tracker we're building at the University of Texas, just because those illustrative examples of biotech, blockchain uses, blockchain in particular, where I think as we've heard from a litany of folks, if you look at the percentage of actual transactions that are fraudulent, it's incredibly low. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't get a headline in the New York Times yep. saying, oh, wow, here's another day that nothing horrible yeah. happened in this blockchain usage. But
and I think that if I could just
yeah, please.
Add on to that, right? Like for some reason, when we compare tech, we're comparing it against the wrong baseline. Cash has plenty of fraudulent transactions.
What? Whoa, that's a headline.
And we, right, so we think about this in AI. We have a startup in our network we just talked to who does like AI for hiring to counter bias, like using not demographic information to evaluate whether a candidate should kind of move along, not literally in a hiring process, but just like you got 1,000 applications, here's the 100 you should look at. And the founder's point that they make pretty eloquently, I think, is without AI, you just have a human doing that. And they're spending 7 seconds on each resume. The AI can at least filter the relevant information. Will there be instances where the AI doesn't have the right data and like, right, the algorithm gets the wrong answer? Of course, but the human would get the wrong answer a lot more. And so to compare the flaws of technology against, I'm not even sure what, we should be comparing against like the flaws of not having the technology, right. Not this weird, perfect technology that doesn't exist. And so I think to your example on blockchain, like when you look at fraudulent transactions, we can't be comparing it to this perfect world where there are none, because that's not the world we live in. We live in a world where even cash has fraudulent transactions. And that's the baseline I think we should use.
Well, I love my tired story of thinking about someone in 1908. They've got the Model T just gets introduced and you ask, hey, I'm on a horse. Do you want to race? You would be wise to take the horse over the Model T. There's no roads, there's no norms, there's no infrastructure. Jaywalking is just walking, right? And so, yeah, I'll take the horse any day. And I think for folks not to realize that a lot of the tech we're building today, its gains, its potential can't be realized until you have that full infrastructure mm-hmm. built out. But you've got a lot of work to do, a lot of founders to call, maybe a trip to Omaha. What do you think the little tech agenda will look like in 5 years?
I think it'll look, I think the underlying policy issues will look the same. I think infrastructure, talent, capital, all of that will still be incredibly relevant. I think it'll be a different face. I think the startups that we're working with today, hopefully, I mean, realistically, won't be in the same position in 5 years. Some of them will have failed, right? That a lot of startups do that. Some of them will get acquired and be building products that like complement other products, which I think is super exciting and an important exit that's like, we need to keep in mind many startups want that. And then some of them will just have grown into larger companies and won't think of themselves as little tech anymore. But we know we'll have a whole new generation of little tech companies with probably products I can't even imagine yet, working in spaces I can't even imagine. And I think that's what is so exciting about being in this space. It's new literally every day. I do worry, though, that the little tech agenda will continue to get kind of misused by policymakers who think, oh yeah, like you said, this doesn't impact startups, so it's okay, we got little tech sign off, or like we're working on protecting little tech. And it's like, well, you, these companies, some of them don't even exist yet. How can you be protecting them? You can't even talk to them. You have to be more forward looking than that. And so I think the agenda will be incredibly relevant, the face will be slightly different, and protecting the integrity of it will be even more important.
Wow. Well, I'm excited to see what happens in 5 years. Maybe we'll have you back on, depending on who the heck we are and where the heck we are. But Kate, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you so much for having me.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.